Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, covering Kingston City Council's decision to scrap the idea of a vacant home tax.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca. At their April 1st meeting, Council unanimously decided not to move forward with implementing a vacant home tax following a recommendation from city staff. Vacant homes exacerbate the limited housing inventory, contributing to rising prices and affordability challenges. A vacant home tax would impose fees on property owners of deemed vacant homes, with the goal of addressing these issues. Anne Lindsay with Public Sector Advisory Services at KPMG Canada briefed Council on the feasibility of the program. She described the reasoning behind implementing a vacant home tax.
Really, the two main drivers of a vacant home tax are the objectives to increase the housing supply and affordability. A vacant home tax targets residential properties that are unoccupied for an extended period of time. And that financial penalty placed on owners is meant to incentivize the owners to sell or rent those underutilized homes. And that would result in an increase in the overall housing supply by pushing those underutilized properties back onto the market. The other driver is to generate tax revenue, typically dedicated to affordability initiatives. So tax revenue generated from a vacant home tax could be reinvested into affordable housing initiatives, rental assistance programs, and homelessness prevention. But it is important to note that a vacant home tax should really be viewed as a temporary measure to address an immediate need of housing availability rather than a long-term revenue source. The long-term goal of the tax is really to motivate change in the behavior of property owners and eventually eliminate the need for the tax in the future when all homes are occupied.
Other Ontario municipalities have put similar taxes in place, including Ottawa, Toronto, Hamilton, Windsor, and Sault Ste. Marie. However, the tax is still relatively new to the province.
Other than Vancouver, who's had a vacant home tax since 2017, it is very new in Ontario. So Toronto was the first to implement in 2022. So we're really only 3 years in to seeing what is happening in the Ontario market.
The City of Kingston originally started considering the tax in 2023. Lindsay's briefing outlined that implementation would either require property owners to self-declare their property as vacant, or the city would act on complaints from other people. The program would require substantial administrative resources to enforce compliance, including annual property status declarations from owners. The initial setup for a self-declaration-based system would cost between $535,000 and $995,000. With annual operational costs projected to be $250,000. A complaint-based system would be less expensive, requiring about $107,000 to set up and $77,000 annually to maintain. While the tax could theoretically generate revenue for affordable housing initiatives, the potential for tangible change in behavior among property owners remains uncertain. Lindsay also highlighted that annually only 2 to 7 additional properties might be put on the market as a result of the tax. The hefty costs and uncertainty surrounding the effectiveness of the program raised eyebrows amongst councillors, and ultimately led to the staff recommendation not to move forward. Kingston's circumstances have also changed significantly since this investigation began in 2023. While Kingston's vacancy rate in 2023 was only 0.8%, giving cause for the city to motivate property owners to sell unoccupied homes or make them available to be rented, Kingston's current vacancy rate is now 2.9%, which is above the provincial average of 2.7%. Councillor Don Amos asked Lindsay about how this impacts the recommendation.
In your opinion, is the 2.9% Kingston vacancy rate heading and trending in the right direction that potentially this vacancy tax is not really justified in moving forward with?
So typically, CMHC standards is that a 3% vacancy rate is considered healthy for communities. So I would, my recommendation would align with CMHC's determination that an approximate 3% vacancy rate would be a healthy vacancy rate for the community.
Overall, it was unanimously agreed by council that the costs and uncertainties would outweigh the potential effectiveness of a vacant home tax. As Kingston continues to navigate its housing challenges, the city plans to explore alternative strategies that may prove more effective in increasing availability for affordable housing in the community. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you to Christina Laurie for that story. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for The Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forestell, about the measles outbreak in southeastern Ontario.
Thank you, Jesse. Canada officially eliminated measles in 1998, but recent outbreaks of the highly contagious virus have public health officials urging people to get vaccinated. Dr. Gerald Evans is the medical doctor of infection prevention and control at Kingston Health Sciences Center and a professor at Queen's University with decades of experience in infectious disease management and prevention. Evans confirmed that as of April 3rd, there were 36 cases of measles in the Southeast Health Unit. He called measles the quintessential airborne virus, explaining that the virus is spread primarily through aerosol droplets. Evans added that the virus is stable in the environment, meaning that it can survive on surfaces after initial exposure. In a Friday, March 7th, 2025 letter to Ontario Health Units, the province's Chief Medical Officer of Health, Dr. Kieran Moore, said that there was an exposure at a large gathering with guests from Mennonite communities in New Brunswick in the fall of 2024. The gathering was large and involved people from all over Canada who then traveled back to their home provinces bringing measles with them. And because it's a vast group of people across the country in various unvaccinated communities, those were all the cases, Evans said. According to the University of Waterloo's Conrad Grebel University College website, there are about 175,000 Mennonites in Canada and about 59,000 in Ontario. Mennonite groups are found across Canada, with over half the population residing in urban areas such as Winnipeg, Vancouver, and Kitchener-Waterloo. Evans acknowledged that the risk to the general public is low given Ontario's 96% vaccination rate. Still, Evans advised that adults born between 1970 and 1985 should consider getting a measles booster. Evans stated that measles is the most contagious viral disease in the world. Evans noted that if 20 susceptible people were exposed to the virus, 18 would contract it. He then compared that with the rate of transmission for COVID-19, which would see only 3 to 4 vulnerable people contract the virus. Measles can lead to a number of complications that can have dire health risks, such as pneumonia and encephalitis. Evans said, frankly, that the only real prevention is vaccination. If you suspect you have measles or you have been exposed to a case of measles, Evans said, you should call your doctor for advice, either your personal physician, a clinic, or an emergency department. Thank you to Michelle Dory Forestell for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LJI reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about the future of the Leeds and Thousand Islands Public Library.
Thank you, Dinah. It began, as these things often do, with talk of archives, but as discussion grew, it quickly became clear that the Leeds and Thousand Islands Public Library Board wasn't just tending to books or buildings, but rather to something bigger, like identity, community, and the quiet power of public spaces. The board met at the Sealy's Bay branch on March 24th for its monthly check-in, touching on everything from national initiatives to local volunteerism. The Archives Association of Ontario has proclaimed April 7th through the 11th as Archives Awareness Week, framing this year's theme around reflection, calling it, quote, "reflecting the communities that build us." Closer to home, the township's own archives team has something to celebrate. A recent award from the Ontario Library Association is currently on display at the township office, but will eventually find its permanent home in the newly renovated Escott Hall. Renovation work there and at Springfield House is already underway. Volunteer hours dipped in February, but the heartbeat of the archive remains strong. The board also dug into the nuts and bolts of policy, reviewing new drafts on safety, emergencies, and community information. Nothing was passed just yet, as members felt these items could be folded into existing frameworks. A deeper discussion on the collection development policy led to a decision to push the vote to May, with a new recommendation being on the table, that a portion of future acquisitions be sourced locally. On the digital front, the board discussed Hoopla, a streaming platform that has become a darling among library users for its smorgasbord of content like movies, music, audiobooks, and more. While other libraries have dropped the service due to its pricey pay-per-use model, the Leeds Thousand Islands Public Library is holding on, recognizing just how much the community values it. There's also a potential step towards charitable status in the work. The library's CEO is in talks with the township's Director of Corporate Services about crafting a policy that would allow the issuance of tax receipts for donations, an important move for future fundraising. Next up, the board meets again on May 26th at 5 p.m. at the Lyndhurst branch. As always, the public is welcome to attend.
And thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to LJI reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about Napanee Town Council's decision to reject a proposal tabled by concerned citizens.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. Concerns raised by neighboring property owners of a proposed development on Bridge Street West were brought to staff at the County of Lennox and Addington, but the proposal town staff made was ultimately denied. Bash Developments has proposed a residential subdivision with 138 single detached dwellings, 124 townhouse dwellings, and mixed-use buildings consisting of 10 live-work units. The development would include the creation of new roads, park space, and stormwater management ponds. Residents were mainly concerned about the increase of traffic in the area. At a public meeting last month, three residents brought up the concerns of their own and their neighbors. Those who spoke also noted they bought their homes realizing there may be future developments, but were only expecting they would be low density. County staff ultimately decided the layout as proposed is the most technically feasible from a traffic management perspective. Michael Nobes with the town's Growth and Infrastructure Services Department explained the proposals staff made and the outcome of their meetings with county staff.
We've had a few conversations with the county transportation staff about potentially reorienting roads and making new connections to Cherrywood to alleviate new connections to Bridge Street. There's significant resistance around that. We proposed a number of mitigation measures, but they're unfortunately not willing to accept any new connections and intersections south of what has been shown. So we've really done as much as we can to try to mitigate those concerns that were brought up. But unfortunately, given what the class of that road will be, they're not supportive of any new connections to essentially reroute traffic from that subdivision's south end to put those traffic onto Cherrywood from that southerly area. So unfortunately, we weren't able to see any changes there with the county.
Nobes noted that residents are welcome to provide their input at any time.
Staff are always open to receiving comments up until the time at which an application is brought back to council. I would encourage any residents to send any comments to developmentservices@greaternapanee.com. So that is goes to a number of staff. So we'll be sure that we get eyes on it and that we can provide pertinent responses to the resident ahead of any recommendation meeting. But any comments that come into that email address will be included on any future council agendas where staff are making any recommendations regarding applications. So I would encourage any residents to send to that email address.
Nobes mentioned when staff were looking to bring the matter back to council.
We'll make sure that those comments are captured and included on council agenda when we bring this back for a recommendation. We're targeting an April 8th, so the next meeting of council, bringing it back for a recommendation. From a technical perspective, we've reviewed everything and the comments that were brought up during that public meeting. We have responses to those, and we'll build that into our recommendation report. But any comments that do come in, we'll strive to get responses directly to those residents ahead of that meeting so they at least can see that and ask any further back and forth questions.
Staff also asked the developer to add additional buffering on the north side of Bridge Street West, and that they seek authorization from landowners on the south side of Bridge Street West to add plantings on their properties. This would help address concerns related to headlights entering into dwellings and provide a visual buffer with the new development and an existing development on the south side of Bridge Street West. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJPE Prince Edward County, Brenda Little, with a story about the launch of the newly redesigned St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church.
It's been an 18-year journey for the historic St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church in Picton to be transformed and rebranded. Saturday was the official launch party of The Andrew, a space for every story. With renovations now complete, the once dark traditional sanctuary is now a bright, welcoming space, emitting a sense of calmness the second one walks in. When Reverend Lynn Donovan arrived in 2007, she envisioned a space to be welcoming and to be shared with the entire community, a fully accessible place to host arts and cultural events, music and celebrations, a place that not-for-profit groups could meet and alternative spiritual practices could enjoy. Saturday was an icy day in Picton, but the launch party went ahead anyway, and the people came to celebrate the new era of The Andrew. The party featured activities for kids, food, refreshments, and entertainment for all to enjoy. I spoke with Lynn about the journey. Lynn, you've been here quite some time, and I think you've had this vision for quite some time as well. What would you like to talk about?
It's true that I arrived here 18 years ago, and I came with a mandate. For getting creative about how we could take the essential values from the Judaic Christian tradition and kind of create a renaissance or a rebirth of this tradition so that it might better serve the community in this time and place. We were getting ready to reimagine the sanctuary in the fall of 2019. We've met with Doreen Balabanov, who is an architect and designer, and we actually had a workshop with her the first week of March, about 10 days before the world ended, and we shared with her this cosmic vision that we had for this sacred space. So, for example, before this third renovation, we had no natural light in the building. The ceiling was dark. It was just dark. And what we said as a circle of friends were a couple of things. One, we wanted to still be connected to the natural world when we came into this space. So we wanted to be connected to the sanctuary of earth and sky. We wanted light. And the second thing we said was, we actually don't come here to hide from the world. We come here to be empowered and encouraged to be deeply connected and to live with purpose and vision in the world. And I will mention her today because what she ended up giving us in terms of the final transformation of the sanctuary was more than we could have imagined. She gave us the most exquisite space. And the real intention was to kind of minimize the traditional religious flavor of the space and make it a more inclusive space, a space that felt safe, and that kind of enabled community to meet under a much broader tent. So this last year, I would say, I'm not sure which project was the most challenging, but recognizing last January that we needed a rebrand, though we'd been discussing it for some time, pulling together the team that made it possible, coming up with the name The Andrew, meeting with the branding professional, having somebody in-house who designed the logos. And The Andrew really is, I think, represents a collaboration between the circle of friends that is the very diverse community of faith that still calls The Andrew home, and more partners in the wider community than I could even name. And I think it really does speak to the fruition of the last 18 years, where we have been building community partnerships and seeking to be with people and to glean the wisdom of other people. I know that colonial Christianity always kind of thought that it needed to be in charge and it had the truth. And, you know, that's just not the path we're on right now, nor have we been for some time. So it is a, like I say, the rebrand for the congregation, formerly known as St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church, is a circle of friends, and a rebrand of the building is the Andrew. And yet, I think at the end of the day, the values of the Andrew are community, inclusivity, courage, joy, and, oh my goodness, how did I forget the fourth one? Really are aligned with the brand, with the values of the Circle of Friends, which in 2007 we said we're going to be curiosity, creativity, and courage, all for the sake of contributing to the well-being of the wider community, which is kind of at the heart of our spiritual tradition. You know, those three little words, love your neighbor.
Would you say that other churches are going through similar challenges?
Of course, every church at present time probably is struggling in some way or another. That season, known as Christendom, is in decline, and COVID actually made it even more challenging. Yet every congregation needs to determine what their own unique path is in this time and place.
To move forward.
Yeah, and you know, within the Presbyterian Church in this region, in 2022, we closed three churches, one in Belleville, one in Trenton, and one in Kingston. And that's the trend across the country. And, you know, some numbers would say that by 2030, 50% of all churches will be closed. And I guess the next point would be, and many, many more, will be rarely used, underused, and really just serving a very small community.
Congratulations, Lynn. I see great things for this space.
Well, thank you. And, you know, like I say, it's taken a whole team and really a whole vision to help realize this vision. And again, you know, I also say that we have got to create either the parable or the antidote to some of the larger geopolitical challenges that we're living in the midst of, and therefore we make these choices daily. And I guess my favorite quote is by Margaret Wheatley, a sociologist and historian, who said, whatever the problem, community is the answer. And we just want to be part of the answer right now.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca, and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Over now to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN Coburg, Dan Jones, with a story about the dismissal of discrimination charges against a Coburg police constable.
The Human Rights Tribunal of Ontario has dismissed a discrimination complaint against the Coburg Police Service by one of its constables. Larry Davis was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder in 2017. He attempted to return to work in 2019 but experienced recurring symptoms. He has been on workers' compensation with employer top-up since being diagnosed. Davis has been found to be permanently restricted from his position since that time. He alleges discrimination with respect to employment, contracts, and membership in an occupational association on the basis of his disability, as well as reprisal. That according to a March 19th decision from the tribunal. The tribunal has a one-year limitation on new claims so that allegations can be dealt with quickly. Davis, in some allegations, are 6 to 7 years old. He claims that his relationship with management quickly deteriorated when he served as vice president of the Police Officers Association and was involved with the negotiations of a new collective bargaining agreement. He alleges unfair treatment when reprimanded for personal use of his work email. He also alleges unfair treatment and failure to accommodate when he went off work in 2017 and throughout his subsequent attempts to return to work through 2019, the decision read. The accusations that are within the time limitation are centered on payroll deduction. Davis represented himself at the tribunal. Human rights adjudicator Sally Ashton found that Davis has failed to provide a factual basis that could support a finding of discrimination or reprisal, or that any of the events occurred within the one-year filing of the application. Ashton ruled that Davis's role with the Police Officers Association is not protected under employment rules, as the association is a separate entity. The tribunal may have considered Davis's untimely claims under a good faith explanation. However, Ashton concluded that Davis did not demonstrate he experienced difficulties with the process, given his medical condition. Ashton stated that Davis's allegations of discrimination are to be outside the jurisdiction of the tribunal. Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, April 10th, we're going to see a daytime high of 6 degrees with a mix of sun and cloud, dropping down to zero overnight with a 30% chance of precipitation. Friday, April 11th, a little bit warmer, closer to what we saw over the weekend with a daytime high of 8 degrees, and it will be cloudy, staying above zero at 1 degree overnight. Saturday, April 12th, we're going to see a daytime high of 9 degrees, so staying in that consistent temperature range, and it will be cloudy, dropping down to zero overnight. Sunday, April 13th, the first double-digit day of the week, daytime high of 10 degrees, dropping down to 3 overnight, and moving into the start of next week, Monday, April 14th, we're going to see a daytime high of 13, but there will be a 50% chance of precipitation, and it will be dropping down to 5 degrees overnight. This is Jesse Bell with the City of Kingston Traffic Report for the week. Reminder that reduced load restrictions are in effect for Kingston as of March 1st. Heavy trucks and loads are restricted on city roads where posted. These restrictions help reduce the damage to roads in the spring. A complete list of roads with restrictions can be found in the Traffic Bylaw section of the City of Kingston website. Here are your road closures for the week. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson, is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess to 486 Albert, is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Victoria Street, between Union and Johnson, is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Queen Street, from Wellington Street to King, is closed for the rerouting of hydro conduits by a Utilities Kingston contractor. Queen Street from Ontario to King Street East is closed for the dismantling and removal of the tower crane at 18 Queen Street, weather permitting. Berry Street from Queen to Colborne is closed for the demobilization of equipment from the 283 Queen Street site. The Hanson Memorial Parking Structure Restoration Project is underway. The work will take place throughout all levels of the building and will include efforts such as routine structural maintenance, repainting, replacement of waterproofing materials, and upgrades to the building's mechanical and electrical systems. The work is set to conclude in July of 2025. Here are some other delays you should be aware of. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club. Expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford. Expect delays beginning April 7th while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abidon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abidon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Montreal Street at John Counter. Expect delays for upgrades to the intersection including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users and accommodate increased traffic from the Wabun Crossing. Victoria Street and Earl Street to Union and Johnson. Expect delays beginning April 7th while a contractor mobilizes to start work on the second phase of reconstruction for sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.